Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, when beekeepers are in trouble, they often turn to the nation's top research lab. But the federal government is closing the Midwest lab, and that has many worried about what it could mean for those who raise bees and the bees themselves. There is a push in Illinois to change how public higher education is funded, but there are some different views on how it should be done. We'll talk with an artist whose portraits of first-time women voters is touring Illinois. We'll also hear about people helping immigrants during the deportation crackdown, including a woman, a stranger, who stepped in to help children left behind when their mother was taken away. And in our history segment, Illinois was the first state to put limits on child labor. We'll look back at the landmark law. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. More than a million honeybee colonies have died across the U.S. in recent years, and colony die-offs are continuing. When such disasters strike, the U.S. Department of Agriculture researchers step in, but the nation's premier federal bee research lab is slated to close. As Harvest Public Media's Macy Byers reports, that could have a big impact on the honeybee industry.
It's a sunny March day in Omaha, Nebraska. In a community garden surrounded by historic downtown buildings, beekeeper Mark Welsh is taking advantage of the nice weather and checking on his honeybee hives.
There's nothing much more relaxing than sitting next to a beehive in the spring, especially, and watching them bring in different colored pollens. You know, you've got red, yellow, brown, blue.
Though Welsh enjoys tending to his bees, last year wasn't so relaxing.
I had 12 hives going into the winter. I lost 9 of them and had 3 left.
Welsh's situation was not unusual. About 1.6 million colonies died across the U.S. in the winter of 2024, affecting everyone from commercial beekeepers to backyard honey producers. Project Apis M, a bee research nonprofit, also found many beekeepers lost 60 to 80% of their colonies. In times of crisis, beekeepers usually turn to the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center in Maryland. Researchers there have been studying bees since the 1930s.
Normally, the USDA is one of our biggest advocates in our industry.
That's Danielle Downey, Project Apis M's executive director.
That's where we would hear from leadership about how bees are doing, and if there was a crisis, it would be the USDA that really is a big voice about raising awareness and trying to get support for our agriculture.
But she says last year, communication with the USDA, including researchers, was sparse. Communication requests went unanswered, and research findings were not widely shared. Jeff Pettis was a honeybee researcher at the Beltsville facility for 20 years, and he led the bee lab for nearly half that time.
It basically was the crown jewel of all the agricultural research of USDA. Everyone's like, oh, you're lucky you're working in Beltsville. I mean, we were the flagship.
Over the years, Pettis says Beltsville's bee lab has helped tamp down risk in beekeeping with products and research solutions. But last July, the USDA announced it would close the entire facility. Pettis says the announcement couldn't come at a worse time.
Right now, we're worried as much about the bees as we are about the beekeepers. Beekeepers having it to be a viable option to keep bees, and we need them. We need them for apples. We need them for almonds. We need them for clover pollination, all kinds of things.
Though no timeline of the closure has been released, USDA staff will be relocated to other labs. And Pettis says experienced researchers could walk away. In a statement to Harvest Public Media, a USDA spokesperson said the proposed closure saves taxpayer dollars, consolidates resources, and, quote, allows USDA to deliver on its mission to the American people. With the uncertain fate of federal bee research, universities are the next line of defense for disease response and research. Garrett Slater is a honeybee researcher at Texas A&M, which will soon open a disease testing lab funded by the state.
I think at this point, with the federal government being in limbo, that maybe it does come down to the state level and that we need to kind of develop things in a different way than we've always done it.
Slater has also worked as a USDA bee researcher and says the Beltsville facility is a key disaster response hub. But state or regional testing, he says, may be the next best option if its bee lab is dissolved. Back in Omaha, beekeeper Mark Welsh is gearing up for another busy season. In the summer, he spends up to 6 hours a day caring for his hives.
Put it this way, my wife considers herself a bee widow in the summertime. That gives you any idea how long I'm gone.
Testing for mites, feeding the bees, and harvesting honey is a lot of work. But for Welsh, it's worth it. And despite the setbacks, he and his bees aren't giving up. I'm Macy Byers, Harvest Public Media.
Food pantries are bracing for an uncertain future because of changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Evan Holden has details.
According to the Illinois Department of Human Services, 120,000 people could lose their benefits because able-bodied people up to age 64 now have to work or volunteer 80 hours a month to keep their SNAP benefits. The changes took effect May 1st. Congress also changed these work requirements to include parents whose youngest child is 14 years old, down from 18 years old. For those who lose their SNAP benefits, food pantries become a vital resource. Many pantries were already struggling to meet the need. Hilda Grismore of Bloomington is a SNAP recipient. She was in line for a food basket at St. Vincent de Paul Pantry because she is currently unable to work and fears she will lose benefits.
The SNAP really helps everyone, you know. When you're hungry, you get angry. When you in line, people get angry. So just try to keep everybody as humble as you go through this program.
Judy Adelman is a volunteer coordinator at St. Vincent de Paul. She says food pantries like St. Vincent de Paul can help families save money for other necessities, but that help only goes so far.
This is a supplement. They may only come once a month or once every 6 or 8 weeks, but it's enough to supplement them to get them through that so that then the money that they do earn can go to utilities and go to rent.
Adelman says there was an increase in people coming to the pantry during the government shutdown last November, but it has since decreased.
And a lot of the people that come through here are, they are already working. They're not all on SNAP benefits. A lot of them are working, but they're working in underpaying jobs or they're working only part-time jobs because that's all they can get.
Food pantries like St. Vincent de Paul rely on donations from the community to buy food for those in need. Adelman says rising meat prices have limited how much they can buy. At Oasis Community Outreach in Bloomington, Director Craig Stimpert says donations help them buy a good supply of meat for their pantry by buying in bulk.
The meat prices are very high right now, and so that is a challenge for us. But we're fortunate to live in a generous community in which people do truly meet that need for us.
Stimpert says he does not know what to expect with the changes in SNAP requirements, but did mention there was an increase of people coming to the pantry during the government shutdown in November when SNAP benefits stopped.
More with fear, I think, or just the uncertainty that brought a lot of people in.
Stimpert says Oasis is working with other Bloomington Normal food pantries to make sure people get food. Advocates for seniors worry expanding the work rule requirement to age 65 will force more older Americans to find a job or volunteer work or seek other exemptions such as disability. Tessa Mahoney is Executive Director of Central Illinois Agency on Aging. She says her organization does not want people to miss out on the benefits they are entitled to.
Because we're concerned that the changes will make it harder for those specific age groups, 60 to 64, which are caregivers, people with disabilities, and people with limited transportation or technology access.
Mahoney says the Central Illinois Agency on Aging does not help with filling out SNAP forms, but can provide resources by pointing people to organizations that can help before they miss meals.
We're happy to help them navigate those benefits, navigate volunteer opportunities, and help connect them with resources where they could volunteer.
Illinois lawmakers have introduced several SNAP-related bills this spring. One would provide support to families losing their benefits, One would ensure refugees can stay on SNAP, and another measure would create a task force to research the effects of the changing SNAP requirements.
Evan Holden with that report. In Illinois, both sides of the aisle want to reform how the state funds higher education. They agree the current system is broken, but lawmakers have competing visions of what an overhaul should look like. Peter Medlin has details.
Depending on who you ask, Illinois is either not spending nearly enough on public universities or spending more than any state in the country.
And everybody deserves equal education.
The hundreds of students, faculty, and staff from universities across Illinois who rallied at the Capitol a few weeks ago believe there needs to be a lot more state investment. Mark Van Wienen is an English professor at Northern Illinois University and president of the Tenure and Tenure Track Union, and he was part of a busload from NIU that made the trip to Springfield to support the Adequate and Equitable Public University Funding Act. It's a higher ed funding plan proposed by Democratic lawmakers.
Our institutions have been starved of resources by the state.
When you account for inflation, state appropriations for higher ed have gone down 40% since 2002. Back then, most university revenue came from state funding. Only about 25% came from tuition and fees. And Van Wienen says now that is flipped.
The current day Husky at NIU is covering 65%.
He says you can draw a direct line from the decline of state appropriations to the skyrocketing price of tuition. And it's created a situation where it's often cheaper for Illinois students to pay out-of-state tuition somewhere else rather than attend college close to home. Everyone, Republicans and Democrats, hates this. And where they all agree is that pretty much everyone wants to change how the state funds public universities. They argue there is no system. Right now, the state just looks at what schools got last year and then gives all universities a flat increase or decrease. Republican State Representative Jeff Kiker says the current system rewards failing schools. He just introduced his own higher ed reform bill to build a 10-year sustainability plan for state universities. And he argues it doesn't make sense if one university loses students and another gains them that they both get the same increase.
So they're getting significantly less per student than they did before, and it's almost a disincentive to enroll additional students because you're not getting the money you need.
The other side says the current system's broken because it doesn't weigh factors like how many low-income students schools serve and which have larger endowments. A state commission's report, which is the basis of the equitable funding bill, found that no public universities are getting enough money to support their students. But as Van Wienen says, some are much closer than others.
This commission determined that NIU is at approximately 56% of adequacy.
It found that the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has 92% of the funding it needs. And Van Wienen says it's a reason why, while most public universities like NIU have seen steep enrollment declines over the past few decades, the University of Illinois system keeps setting enrollment records. The equitable funding plan wants to fix that by pouring hundreds of millions of extra dollars into universities, prioritizing the schools furthest away from adequate funding. And although most Illinois public universities support this plan, the University of Illinois system doesn't. They say it would lead to tuition increases for them. Elaine Gabrick is the director of policy analysis at the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. It's a nonprofit research group that supports the equitable funding plan. And Gabrick says no universities, including U of I, would ever receive less money than they do right now under the equitable plan.
Yes, they receive a smaller portion of those new funds that would go through the formula. But when you look at how far away certain other universities in the state are from what they need to successfully serve their students, that just makes sense.
But Republican Representative Jeff Kiker says that state funding should strengthen the schools and the programs that students are choosing.
The dollars to the university should follow the student. So that should be the state support, and that should also be the tuition support.
But remember when I said that some people argue Illinois actually spends the most on higher ed? That's a point Kiker makes. Illinois' higher ed spending per full-time student is the highest in the country.
Throwing more money at them through this, it's going to create actually a bigger need for more state income, tax, and revenue.
So how can Illinois be spending the most and not spending nearly enough? Can both of those things be true at the same time? Well, Elaine Gabrick says Yeah, actually it can.
That does not take into account, first of all, the payment to the state university retirement system. So in FY 2025, that was about $2.2 billion. So just to put things into perspective, that's 43% of total state funds.
Basically, she says a lot of state higher ed money isn't actually going to students. It's paying for pensions, mostly pension debt service. But even if you remove pension money from that equation, Gabrick says Illinois is still above average when it comes to spending per full-time student, but she believes it's even more complicated because of another issue. Illinois public universities have over $8 billion worth of deferred maintenance.
It's hard to say exactly how much this has affected the appropriations per student.
So since Kiker doesn't think universities are underfunded, why is it that enrollment's dropping so far at some schools and not at others? He says there are a lot of factors that play into this, and it would be a big question for his commission to explore. And he's also deeply concerned about the looming enrollment cliff hitting universities across the country.
You're going to look at a third fewer students. There aren't as many people that are coming through the system. So if we don't right size now and we continue to do this, we are going to pull down all of the Illinois higher education institutions by trying to save them all.
He says the state should at least consider radical change. And that could be downsizing some campuses. He says maybe struggling schools could attract talent by specializing in the trades or fine arts.
Failure tomorrow is quickly arriving. And if we don't do it now, we're going to be in a real big world of hurt within the next 5 years.
Again, NIU's Mark Van Wienen.
It is an offense that legislators blame our institutions for declines in enrollment when they are the ones who have under-resourced our institutions.
And he says that, ironically, the universities lacking the most resources are also the ones best equipped to serve the students failed by the current status quo. I'm Peter Medlin.
We'll return with more of Statewide in just a moment.
This is Statewide. Four monumental portraits of first-time women voters are currently touring Illinois. Jane Carlson talked with the artist.
The 7-foot-tall portraits began as scraps from a voters' rights mural and took shape through imagery inspired by an iconic suffrage-era poster. The mixed-media works depict liberty, justice, freedom, and forward, their eyes gazing directly at viewers and their bodies grounded in Midwestern landscapes. Artist Nikki Johnson created the works using materials left behind from the 2020 installation of Shepherd Fairey's Voting Rights or Human Rights mural in Milwaukee.
I saw these clear garbage bags that were being loaded with stencil paper and spent cans. And I just thought to myself, I don't think that's trash. I think that's power.
Johnson stored the materials in her attic for 4 years. Then in 2024 and 2025, she and 8 other Milwaukee artists built the large-scale portraits based on Bertha Boyd's 1911 Votes for Women poster. 70 volunteers, ranging in age from 12 to 82, helped with the project.
We had Girl Scouts in here. We had furloughed federal workers. And people were finding their way to the studio for different reasons on different days. But by the end of a couple hours of being in here, you could tell that no matter how heavy the news, no matter what was happening in people's lives, the number of caregivers who were coming in, there was a sense of wholeness and community that they were walking out of the door with.
Johnson says that sense of wholeness and community is what she is facilitating as the portraits combining suffrage-era design and contemporary protest materials travel Illinois as the exhibit Pillars of Democracy, Unite and Rise. It's an art tour using the portraits and civic dialogue as a way to emphasize the role of women in the democratic process, supported by the League of Women Voters of Illinois and a Healing Illinois grant.
While these ideas are kind of part and parcel to how we understand our values as Americans, they are activated on the local level by people like me and you every day.
At each stop, Johnson leads an interactive workshop to explore identity, voice, and civic engagement. She says the portraits are large, powerful figures, but are packed with detail and density.
So there's a bit of a push and pull between something that feels monumental and yet intimate. So typically what happens is the audience will become engaged by first making eye contact with the figures who are looking forward and making eye contact with the viewer. They feel embodied. They feel empowered.
Viewers begin discovering smaller details embedded throughout the collages. Native plants and bodies of Midwestern water, just as Boyd's poster had a figure standing in front of the San Francisco Bay. And quilt-inspired patterns down the center of each figure's dress.
The overarching reason why those quilt patterns are there is as a nod to our foremothers and the generations of women who came before us, who never had the right to vote. The women who fought so valiantly for the right to vote, 1920s, and again, 1960s, continued depending on what population still was being denied.
Johnson says the portraits are rooted in the suffrage movement and racial healing and in new concerns about voting access and women's rights.
The way that there's a true encroachment on women's rights, this is the moment, really, for women to see the power we hold. We've always held.
I'm Jane Carlson.
That exhibit now displayed at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. A Democratic congressman representing Central Illinois in Washington says he's not satisfied with the answers given by the Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth about military layoffs in his district. Lauren Warnicki reports.
In a recent hearing held by the House Armed Services Committee, Eric Sorensen questioned Secretary Hegseth about the decision to cut up to 150 jobs at Rock Island Arsenal. Sorensen's district cuts through Bloomington Normal and Greater Peoria and winds up through the Quad Cities and Rockford. Rock Island Arsenal contains headquarters for Army Sustainment Command and Joint Munitions Command, which manage the production and distribution of ammunition and weapons. The department pegged the layoffs as surplus jobs, despite escalating need to replenish stockpiles amid the ongoing war in Iran. Hegseth told Sorensen he'd have to look into the particulars.
But there have been places where we haven't been moving fast enough with munitions, and when people don't move fast enough in the Department of War, we find someone else that will run fast.
This is Joint Munitions Command. I mean, your department says that you're prioritizing munitions, yet you cut 58% of Joint Munitions Command at Rock Island. But let me move on. My district is also
Are not built by commands.
They're built by businesses, says Hegseth, who rebranded his department the Department of War late last year. Hegseth says trimming workers has less to do with need and more to do with redefining departmental standards of excellence.
Great performers will always have a job at the Department of War, and when you reestablish merit, sometimes things happen, but we're grateful for all the vets that serve. And in fact, we've created a Patriot pipeline for service members to get into the defense industrial base manufacturing business, to consider that as a second career.
But Hegseth's answers didn't sit well with Sorensen.
These are two essential parts of armed services, and Pete Hegseth is firing people. And we all should be worried about that.
Sorensen took questions during a recent visit to Bloomington Normal. Stops included Normal City Hall, where he announced plans to seek additional federal funding for flood mitigation at Uptown, and at Fairview Elementary School in Normal. Fairview's community school program, in partnership with the Normal nonprofit The Baby Fold, is staring down a June 30th deadline when its federal funding will run out. The Trump administration doesn't plan to continue funding community schools, which provide need-based services to community members at a neighborhood public school. Fairview isn't the only school in the news. The Department of Justice named District 87 in Bloomington and Ridgeview Schools in Colfax among 36 Illinois schools included in an investigation looking for evidence of content about sexual orientation and gender ideology.
June 30th, educators are going to lose their jobs. So am I surprised that he sends the DOJ to a blue state like Illinois? To try to make waves, to try to get us to look away from the fact that he's cutting the education of our students, I'm not going to look away.
Sorensen says the investigation is also designed to distract from gas prices, which peaked last week in Bloomington Normal, a penny shy of $5 a gallon. Sorensen says the House of Representatives missed an opportunity to address gas prices themselves by passing a farm bill without year-round E15. The ethanol fuel blend can't be sold in the summertime, something Sorensen says he's been pushing to change.
If we had year-round E15, we could lower the cost of a gallon of gas, but then also help our farmers. And so I was really dismayed that Republicans from the Midwest didn't stand up for our farmers.
Sorensen says he'll support Iowa Republican Zach Nunn's proposed legislation on E15 after his E15 provision was stripped from the farm bill. A third stop in Bloomington Normal was visiting 24 trades union members to discuss data centers. Sorensen says he's aligned with state Democratic lawmakers in supporting data centers in his Central Illinois district with certain conditions and oversight. Sorensen says he doesn't want to see Illinois lose out to another state or another country, provided data centers keep noise levels, water use, and utility cost bleed in check.
But let's also understand that most data centers aren't taking more water than a brand new club car wash on Veterans Parkway.
McLean County has set a land use policy for data centers. The state has attempted to put forward legislation to limit water and power consumption, but hasn't succeeded yet. I'm Lauren Warnicke.
Two recent high-profile settlements media companies agreed to with the Trump administration have created legal uncertainty for the industry, but not so much in Illinois. That's according to attorney Don Craven. He's been representing media organizations across Illinois for decades. In an interview with Eric Stock, Craven explains sunshine laws in Illinois, including the Freedom of Information Act, have generally been protected.
There are always efforts to insert additional exemptions into FOIA or additional exemptions into the Open Meetings Act, but by and large, it's been pretty positive. There are one or two things that stand out that could be tweaked for the better, but mostly we're in pretty good shape.
Many newsrooms have gotten smaller, more corporate owned. Has that impacted what you've seen on the ground level in terms of journalists and their owners pursuing cases that could potentially end up in litigation?
Yes, the volume of requests, the volume of calls to me, to my office, is down. That's simply because the number of reporters in newsrooms is less. You have less time to work on stories. You're working on fewer, you're not working on fewer stories, but you're, because of the, you're stretched thinner than you were before. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't add to the quality of journalism.
And the ability to aggressively pursue stories that need to be uncovered.
If you have to aggressively pursue a story, if you have to spend legal fees to go get a public record, the answer from above is going to be no.
I want to go back to the thought about the newsrooms being smaller. Another aspect in which the media has changed over the years is the citizen journalist. Everyone with a phone is a reporter now with the capability to broadcast to large groups of people. Has that impacted the dynamic at all?
Yes and no. The proliferation of social media sites, I mean, all of that has impinged, if you will, on the ability of public radio, newspapers, to get the attention of readers and listeners. So it makes it more difficult because just because you see it on somebody's Facebook post doesn't mean that person has done what you have done in order to put a story on the air. But yet you have to fight against the impression that, well, I read it on Facebook, it must be true, and if NPR says something else, then who am I going to believe?
From what we've seen nationally, companies have agreed to settlements to ward off cases. Paramount was one. ABC News was one. How do you look at those cases in the context of what's happening here in Illinois? Are those simply outliers that the Trump administration has been involved in, or do you see long-term impacts there?
Put me in the category of those who disagreed with the decision, for instance, of ABC to settle. There are times when, because of the role that the press plays in our form of government, there are times when the expenses have to be paid to defend our role, mm-hmm. and to fold, settle, and go home for purely economic reasons, I think was not the right decision.
Do you fear that will have a chilling effect, or has it already had, on media?
I think the entire Trump administration has had a chilling effect on everybody except Jimmy Kimmel.
So far.
Because the, you know, Kash Patel sues The Atlantic or whoever, you know, for $250 million. Mm-hmm. That slows people down, intentionally or unintentionally.
So how should a young, fresh reporter, fresh out of school, wide-eyed and ambitious and idealistic, how should they think about this in this moment?
You have to remember why you're doing what you're doing. You have to remember what role the media plays in the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that it's the media's job. The media is an educator. You play the role of an educator to the greater community, and you have to take that role seriously. You have to defend that role, and you have to perform responsibly and professionally, so that you don't put yourself in the category of being the so-called fake news.
Here with media attorney Don Craven, you've been doing this for 40 years. Why have you devoted your career to defending and upholding media and the First Amendment?
My father before me and now my practice is to allow you and other members of the media to do your jobs to the best ability that you can, to protect you when you are attacked, either in a legal proceeding or otherwise. And it's a lot of fun, and you meet a lot of nice people.
While this is something that people in the media and advocates for the media are deeply passionate about, how do you make the case for the general public to be concerned about this at a time when skepticism toward the media is probably at an all-time high?
Well, and to put it, let's approach that from the press side, from the newspaper side. What's the impact on Little Town if the newspaper shuts up and goes away? You get no obituaries, you get no weddings, you get no school news, you get no local sports, you don't get pictures of your kids and grandkids playing football or dancing or whatever. A newspaper is in local radio as well is truly the heartbeat of a community, and communities lose that when local media is forced to go away.
That was the media attorney Don Craven. He spoke with Eric Stock. He spoke at a recent forum with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Even with the harsh winter, ticks are bad this spring. Jess Savage reports on what people can do to protect themselves against tick-borne diseases.
The Centers for Disease Control reports that in nearly every part of the country, weekly emergency room visit rates for tick bites haven't been this high since 2017. In northern Illinois, the most common tick species are dog ticks and deer ticks, which combined can transmit 7 different diseases. Teresa Steckler is an extension specialist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She says they're bad despite the cold winter.
I was hoping that
the really bad winter that we experienced this past, January, where we got really cold weather for an extended period of time. I was hoping that that would curtail some of the ticks, but I don't think it had any impact on them.
Steckler says you should tuck your pants into your socks and your shirt into your pants to keep ticks away from your skin. If you've been bitten by a tick, remove it gently with tweezers and save it in case you develop any flu-like symptoms and bring it with you to consult your doctor. If you don't develop any symptoms, you can submit it for citizen science using a form on Bite Map Illinois. I'm Jess Savage.
More to come on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An Illinois senator from Joliet and local advocates are urging lawmakers to pass a statewide law regulating data centers. Sam Nofsker reports.
In March, the Joliet City Council approved the construction of Illinois' largest data center, despite community backlash and concerns over its energy consumption. Democrat Rachel Ventura is a Senate sponsor of the Power Act. It's a joint chambered proposal establishing more comprehensive guardrails for large-scale data centers. Supporters of the act say it protects Illinois communities from high utility bills and safeguards the environment by requiring plans for water and energy use. Ventura is urging her colleagues to pass the Power Act before the General Assembly adjourns on May 31st. Neither bill has passed the House or Senate yet. I'm Sam Nofsker.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. On May 15th, 1903, Illinois established the nation's first 8-hour workday for children.
8 hours to work, 8 hours to play, 8 hours to do as we may.
The new law also established that children could not work more than 48 hours a week. Before this, everyone knew child labor was bad and dangerous. Factories worked children 12 to 14 hours a day and used them to crawl into hazardous machinery because of their small size. Labor unions, progressive politicians, school officials, the press, even some business leaders tried to change the laws to protect children, but they were up against wealthy, powerful business leaders and politicians who profited off child labor. After decades of fighting, women took charge. In the late 1800s, Jane Addams, women's rights advocate and founder of Hull House, and several female reformers launched a child welfare movement. They recruited women and mothers from all walks of life and lobbied educators, politicians, and judges to regulate child labor. They wanted children out of the factories and in the schools. They argued that if children were not educated and properly socialized, American society would deteriorate. Illinois' 1903 bill also eliminated child labor at night and required child workers to provide proof that they were in school.
I'm so glad I get to learn in school instead of getting mangled by machines and factories.
I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
During the Trump administration's deportation campaign in Chicago, immigration agents took away a mother on Chicago's southwest side. Her three children are all U.S. citizens. They were left to fend for themselves, and they did for nearly 4 weeks. That's until a 27-year-old woman, a stranger, stepped in to help. Chip Mitchell has the story.
Isabel Conde heard from a relative about the three kids, ages 17, 14, and 6. The oldest, she reached him by phone. He agreed to let her visit. Their apartment was in Chicago Lawn.
What I noticed right away was the two girls huddled up together in the door frame in one of the bedrooms.
Huddled?
Yeah, like embracing each other, basically. I led the meeting. I wanted to get all the basic facts. Financially, what was going to happen with their apartment? Medically, what did they have, health insurance? And then legally, what's going on with the mom's case?
Isabel found out the mother had entered the U.S. 2 decades earlier as a teenager. She was raising the three kids on her own. She had no criminal record, but on October 12th, immigration agents picked her up just outside the apartment. They moved her to a detention center in Kentucky. At the apartment, Isabel made a list of all the adults in the kids' lives who might be able to take them in. The father of the two teens, he'd gone back to Mexico. The 6-year-old's father was still in Chicago, but
not employed, could not get a job, and had health and legal issues, and was just frankly not able to care for her.
Isabel tried everyone.
Aunt, uncle, the neighbor, godparents. No one was able to take all three of them. And they had already faced this horrible loss of their mom so suddenly. The last thing they wanted was to be separated again.
Isabel had been working as a paralegal, so she knew the kids were vulnerable while their mother was detained. It was only a matter of time before someone called the state, put them in a shelter. They could be split apart.
Yeah, so then one night I got a call from the kids, and they were in a park, and they shared with me that they left their home and were afraid because the father of the youngest was telling them that he was going to separate them. I was with my mom, and we just got in the car and drove immediately to that park.
It was dark. The kids were pulling a wagon loaded with clothes and a blanket. They were planning to sleep in the park.
I looked at them, and they were scared. I just knew that I could not bear the idea of them being separated.
Isabel's apartment had just two bedrooms. She decided it was big enough.
I was able to take the kids to my house that night.
This apartment right here?
Yeah.
Where did you put these three kids?
I put them in my living room. So right here. My dad had an extra queen-size bed and a twin bed. And so he brought over both of those beds.
They spread them across the living room. Isabel brought in the wagon and threw the kids' clothes in the wash.
I knew for a fact that I was going to have them for that weekend, probably the next week, to work on talking to extended family members and seeing if there was a way to move them.
Isabel also took charge of getting their mother out of immigration detention. She found a pro bono attorney. The legal battles stretched over weeks, then months, and Isabel did her best for all three kids.
I would drive them to and from school every day. Once we got temporary guardianship paperwork signed by their mom, I was really able to start making sure that all of the medical needs were being met. And then I got them into mental health therapy, each of them, because they experienced a severe trauma, and making sure they were getting any resources they needed from, like, social workers at school. My mom, she would come several nights a week and help me care for the kids. She's the art teacher at Ravenswood Elementary School, and they held a fundraiser for us. And I also tapped into community networks, mutual aid funds.
With all the help, Isabel could pay the rent on the family's apartment so it would be there if the mother got out.
We took them to the zoo lights, the trampoline park. We went to the children's museum, the aquarium. The youngest grew out of her clothes like right away. She was just hit a growth spurt. And so we had to get just new clothes for everybody too. They had tamales with us at Thanksgiving, gifts for Christmas to open. And we just really like made them a part of our family.
But Isabel was under increasing stress. Less than 2 weeks into the new year, she started grad school. It wasn't easy with the three kids in her apartment. She needed their mom released from immigration detention.
I would pray every night, ask that these children could be reunited with their mother.
On January 27th, 2.5 months after Isabel took in the kids, a federal judge in Kentucky ruled the mother's detention was unlawful. He ordered her immediate release. The attorney arranged for volunteers in Kentucky to drive the mother to Indiana to a spot there that Isabel could reach.
I immediately rented a van and picked up the kids from school and was like, guys, like, let's go get your mom.
The kids were finally reunited with their mother.
We came back to my apartment. My family, they made pozole and fed her. We gave her fresh clothes, and then she just fell asleep with her kids in my living room.
They stayed with Isabel a few days before returning to their apartment in Chicago Lawn.
And that was that. They were back in their home and back together.
And you were here.
Yeah, and then I was here. And my office that turned into the girls' room was just empty. And so much of the house was just empty. And I was really sad. I was really sad. I love them. And it was the goal all along to reunite them with their mom. But I missed them because we were all like a family for a while.
This spring, the 17-year-old, the boy, he's graduating from high school. The 14-year-old's having a quinceañera. The other girl's finishing kindergarten. The mother, the next hearing in her immigration case, has been postponed to 2028. She's got time to plan for any outcome. Meantime, she has qualified for a work permit. And Isabel has wrapped up her first semester of grad school. But she still misses those kids.
After protecting them for so long, I wanted to just keep being with them all the time, but I knew that it was just the way of things and the way of love.
She had to let them go. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
Raids by federal agents may be out of the headlines right now, but they're not out of mind for many immigrants. ICE arrests are up sharply in most states in the Midwest since President Donald Trump took office again. According to the Deportation Data Project, arrests are up 29% in Illinois. Sheila Brummer reports on people who are stepping in to help immigrants facing uncertainty.
ICE isn't obvious in Sioux City, Iowa, but that doesn't mean immigrants here aren't nervous. Juan agrees to meet for an interview, but doesn't want to share his last name. Even though he speaks fluent English, he chooses to use Spanish, so people won't recognize his voice. Juan says many immigrants live with constant fear, especially those with families. He sits on his living room couch with fingers interlocked, squeezing them tighter as he talks. Juan says he came to the U.S. from Guatemala more than 30 years ago, in search of a better life, and became a U.S. citizen a decade ago. He now owns a successful business and worries about his employees without legal status. Juan calls them good people. Things may seem quiet now in Sioux City, but a growing number of allies prepares for what could come next.
Stand up! Fight back!
Native American activist Manape Lemire has led protest marches against President Trump's immigration policies, including a recent No Kings gathering. Lemire also co-founded the Siouxland Guardians. It's a grassroots organization teaching volunteers rapid response techniques in case of possible ICE activity.
If we didn't have people trained in that, we'd never know about Renee Good or Alex Pretty. We'd never know about it because people wouldn't have known to start recording.
Lemire traveled to Minneapolis to learn more about nonviolent frontline action and brought those strategies back home. Volunteers learn how to use warning whistles, safely interact with agents, and document their actions. There's also a hotline to report ICE sightings. So far, about 30 people are in training.
So we just want to be prepared to receive that family that might come crying. They might come with really hard feelings in their heart about how America's treating them. Well, I just want to reassure them that it's not always the case.
In Oklahoma City, the Immigration Center at Western Oaks Church of the Nazarene receives calls every day from people who are stressed. Lydia Marzouk is the center's executive director.
They have had loved ones or known family or relatives that have been picked up by ICE. They're afraid to process their cases because they don't know if they will be apprehended. Even though they have a legal pathway to come, they still get very nervous.
The nonprofit provides low-cost legal services along with English and citizenship classes. Marzouk sees helping immigrants as part of her church's calling.
And Galatians 5:14 says that you love your neighbors as you love yourself. And that's what God wants us to do as a center, is to love our neighbors, serve our community, and that includes the immigrant community.
In Illinois, another nonprofit is focused on the emotional well-being of immigrants. The Western Illinois Dreamers launched a virtual support group following the ICE surge in February. Executive Director Julia Alvarez and Green started the nonprofit in 2019.
After meeting so many members of the community here and seeing how much they do with so few resources, I was really moved by that.
The organization provides services to thousands of people throughout Western Illinois, including legal advice, housing support, and financial assistance. But Alperez and Green says many immigrants and refugees are now too afraid to travel or even leave their homes, so they started anonymous online meetings.
People are very concerned. People are very isolated, I would say.
Alperez and Green left Venezuela more than 25 years ago. Now, as an American, she strives to offer others stability, support, and reassurance they are not alone. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sheila Brummer.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.